You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, 2019 saw some big changes in immigration on the national level. We'll look at how federal policy changes affected local refugee resettlement here in Wisconsin. First, online dating might seem strange or even terrifying to some. It's a unique concept of our modern age, and it could offer its users a lesson in humanity. Two people sending each other messages trying to prove their realness to a stranger. How do you convey your personality and your humanness over a chat window? How do you show who you are as a real person, not as a robot behind your screen? Well, our next guest found herself thinking of it as a scientific investigation of language and love. C.J. Hauser teaches creative writing and literature at Colgate University in New York. Her most recent novel is called Family of Origin. She wrote an essay for The Guardian about her first time online dating. It's called This is Small Talk Purgatory, What Tinder Taught Me About Love. C.J., welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, this essay is about your first time dating online. Can you talk a little bit about what your thoughts about online dating were before that?
Oh, I was not excited about it. I had heard stories for many years, and I didn't think it was going to be a thing I did, but I live in a very rural place. And I found myself single, and all of a sudden I realized that I was never going to meet someone who wasn't my coworker or my mailman, unless I got brave and tried it out for the first time.
So it sounds like necessity kind of led you to try it and get past those initial hesitancies that you might have had. You went into it with some expectations. You had an idea of the kind of person that you thought you were looking for and how you would tell. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So I think I admit in the essay that this is a somewhat conversation snobby way of approaching things. But I think that because I'm a writer, because I'm a storyteller, I just hope there would be good banter. I really hope there would be this sort of back and forth connection to the way I would relate to someone over text, the way I do with, I don't know, friends who I'm texting with on a daily basis, and that we'd have a kind of rapport. So that's what I guess I thought I was looking for when I started chatting with people.
And what were some of those first conversations you had that more or less might have kind of fit into that expectation?
Well, I had some good chats with some people where there was, I don't know, there was building upon what we were saying to each other back and forth. People had a funny sense of humor, or I could tell that they had a dark sense of humor, or that they had things that they valued. And it was exciting and it was almost shocking. But then when I met those people in real life, they were alarmingly intense. And all of a sudden I was like, perhaps this was not the best rubric to head into this endeavor with. That is probably not surprising to most non-writing, more normal humans. But for me, I was sort of shocked that this like super intensity of personality across chat translated into an even more extreme, exponentially so version in real life.
Well, and for people who may not have done this version of dating or maybe don't do a lot of communicating with even friends or family via different types of texting or chatting, describe a little bit. I mean, these could be really lengthy, in-depth conversations. These weren't just a couple, you know, a couple letters and an emoji.
No, thankfully not in the first case. No, I was talking to people about like what they valued and what they appreciated. And I was talking to some of these people for, you know, like a couple of weeks at a time before I met them in real life, because I don't know, I was trying to be tentative and to get to know people before I did a real online, real life meeting. And so you really felt like you were getting to know someone really well, but of course chat is only one dimension of a person. And there are a lot of other things that once you're sitting there face to face, I don't know, add up to a more full picture.
So interestingly, while you were going through this online dating experience, you were also teaching undergraduate students about robots and artificial intelligence in science fiction writing. And
yes,
you started to kind of see some interesting parallels between those two seemingly very different worlds. Tell us what first kind of sparked for you.
Sure. So it's a class that grew out of, I'd been teaching freshman writing for a really long time. And I found that a lot of students, much like a lot of daters, just wanted to produce what seemed like the correct answer to an essay prompt. And so I would get the same kind of writing over and over again, where it was like an essay that started from the dawn of time. There have been many similarities and differences between insert essay topic here. And so I got frustrated. And I said, you need to write a paper that a robot could not produce. Only you could produce this piece of writing, because otherwise, why write it? And so it sort of grew into this larger class about robots and robotic writing and robots in fiction. I have some very, very wonderful students, and we have great debates in that class. And I was teaching one of my favorite books, which is The Most Human Human by Brian Christian, which is about how he participates in a Turing test in which people are trying to determine whether the entity they're chatting with is a person or a robot. If a robot fools a person into thinking that they are in fact a real person and not a robot, they are said to have passed the Turing test. So Christian was there to be this human blind to sort of, you know, even out the experiment, but he felt like he didn't want to be mistaken for a robot. And he really wanted to think about what is it I can do in language that a robot cannot, to really assert my humanity through language.
We're talking with CJ Hauser right now. She teaches creative writing and literature at Colgate University in New York. And we're talking about her recent essay for The Guardian about her first time online dating. It's called This is Small Talk Purgatory, What Tinder Taught Me About Love. So there's the Turing test, but there's also something called the potato test. Tell us about the potato test.
Oh, I would love to, because it delights me that this exists. So I'm thinking about sort of how humans can use language to I don't know, express themselves as humans. But of course, as I did research for this piece, I realized that there are actual chatbots, like robots pretending to be people on Tinder and other dating apps. And so a lot of people who got sick of realizing 10 minutes into a conversation they were talking to a robot came up with this thing called the potato test, where you say over chat to the person you're talking to, say potato if you're real. And if the person on the other end of the line just keeps on talking about their dog, then you realize, oh no, they're not saying it back. They don't know what I've asked them, because they're not actually a real person.
And that's interesting. It's all about kind of breaking out of the expected or out of those patterns. And you make a comparison between a chess concept and dating. The chess concept is called being in book. And that is basically the setup for many chess games, where there's a series of expected moves. And it's only when the players move out of that, that things get interesting and someone actually, you know, can kind of outmaneuver their opponent. How does that apply to dating?
Sure. So this is an idea that I also encountered in Christian's book, and that my students are always really interested in talking about, because I think that on a college campus, when you're first getting to know people, they too spend a lot of time stuck in small talk purgatory. But in terms of dating, you start these chats, and there's a kind of way that it can predictably go back and forth in a way that is, you know, pleasant. No one has said anything egregiously upsetting, but you don't really know anything about the other person. So, hi, how are you? Where are you from? What's the weather like where you are? Do you like to go inside to read books? Do you like to go outside to sort of do sports? Oh, yes, I too have once gone to this country. But at a certain point, you just sort of have a baseball card of statistics, and you don't really know who the other person is. And I found that frustrating, and I wanted to do that thing that Christian talks about chess players doing, where they stop playing what are the correct or strategic moves and start sort of improvising and expressing themselves with flair as players.
So what did you do to go outside of the book in dating?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess it's supposed to be something that reveals something about you, but I am a person who loves tiny stories and anecdotes. Like, I love at the end of the day with people in my life, my family or my friends, to be like, here is this conversation I had with a stranger at the post office today, or here is this funny thing that I saw on the news today, and here's how I think about it. What do you think about it? And so I love to give a little anecdote, like something I've gathered from the world that day, and then for someone to sort of react to it or share either a story it reminds them of or their reactions to a new idea. And I don't know, that's what really, I don't know, meaningful communication feels like for me. And that's not to say that's true for everyone, but I was looking for someone I could relate to. That's what I thought of dating as being. So that's how I tried to get out of book.
So in your essay, CJ, you do recount quite a few bad dates. Despite that, or maybe because of that, would you encourage others to try it?
I think that, well, you know what? I think I would encourage people to try to get out of book in life, whether it's in dating or if it's just in interactions, I don't know, in your town on a daily basis. Like, I think it's really nice if you're in line at the post office or trying to make a connection with someone online to say like, hey, like, it's snowing like crazy out right now. It reminds me of the storm when I was 6 and we had this crazy snow angel party. Like, are you going out today? Or are you going to stay inside and stay warm? And just, I don't know, make an effort to be a real human person in your daily interactions. And I know that's something that makes me happy.
Well, CJ, thanks for joining us, and say potato.
Potato.
All right. That was CJ Hauser. She teaches creative writing and literature at Colgate University in New York. Her most recent novel is called Family of Origin. She joined us to talk about her essay for The Guardian called This is Small Talk Purgatory, What Tinder Taught Me About Love. You can find a link to that essay at our website, WPR.org/Central Time. And stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, President Trump delivered remarks today after an Iranian missile strike on 2 Iraqi military bases. We'll discuss what he had to say during our look at the week in Washington. First, 2019 brought some big changes in federal immigration policy, including for refugees. The Trump administration drastically cut the total number of refugees allowed to resettle in the U.S., and that has in turn lowered the number of refugees who are making their homes here in Wisconsin. Our colleagues at WisContext recently took a closer look at the state's refugee resettlement trends in 2019. Will Cushman is an associate editor at WisContext. He spoke to WPR host Keely Boltina about his latest story.
Let's start with the top line numbers. How many refugees made their home in Wisconsin in 2019?
480, which is just a few more than in 2018 when 472 refugees arrived in the state.
What's context for that, though? Is that consistently what we've seen over the years, or did Wisconsin have fewer or more in recent history?
Right. So this leveling off in 2019 from 2018 is a bit of a pause in a trend since 2016 in a pretty steep plummet. In refugees arriving both in Wisconsin and nationally.
Yeah, tell me more about the national scene, because we've heard President Trump and others talk about setting limits on refugees. Is Wisconsin following the same path?
Yes, generally. I will say, I'll qualify that with nationally in 2019, there was a bit more of an increase in the number of refugee arrivals versus 2018. It was up about 20% in 2019 nationally. In Wisconsin, it was pretty much exactly the same.
All right. And when we're looking at it, we've seen a lot of changes under the Trump administration as far as how many refugees are let in. Wisconsin isn't saying we're not taking any more refugees. It's just fewer refugees are coming into the U.S., so that's trickling down?
Exactly. The U.S. State Department really coordinates refugee resettlement with resettlement agencies all over the nation. And the State Department follows guidelines, limits that are set by the presidential administration. Previous administrations set quite higher limits, for the most part, on the number of refugees that could be resettled every year. The limit that President Obama set in 2016 was 110,000 refugees. And then when President Trump took office in early 2017, he actually paused the program momentarily and then decided to set the limit at 50,000. And since then, the limit has been decreasing every year. In fact, the limit for 2020, which that fiscal year, so this goes by federal fiscal years. It's a little confusing. The numbers that I'm reporting are calendar year versus the limits that presidents set are for a federal fiscal year, which starts on October 1st. So that's already started for 2020. That limit this year is 18,000, which is a historically low number.
And do we know if Wisconsin's taken in any refugees since October 1st?
I'm not sure. I've talked to a director of a resettlement agency up in the Fox Valleys, World Relief Fox Valley, or the Fox Cities, excuse me. And she said that they have not resettled any refugees since the beginning of the fiscal year. They have plans to resettle 3 sometime in the coming weeks, but she said it's down precipitously.
Well, we do have 480 refugees who have come to Wisconsin in 2019. Let's talk about those. What do we know about these refugees that have made a new home here?
Right. About 8 countries are refugees are from about 8 countries, I believe, 8 or 9 this last year. And it's there's a few from Syria, from Ukraine, from Iraq, from Afghanistan, Somalia. But the vast majority of the refugees are coming from 2 countries, as has been. It's consistent with previous years. Those 2 countries being Burma, also known as Myanmar, in South Asia, Southeast Asia, and then the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Over 200 refugees have arrived from each of those countries in 2019.
And specifically the Congolese refugees, this is relatively new for Wisconsin.
It is. There were virtually no Congolese refugees as recently as 2013.
And so now they're finding a place. Specifically, where are they going once they come to Wisconsin? Where are the epicenters of places welcoming these refugees?
It's really centered in a few places. Milwaukee continues to be the top destination for refugees in the state, which makes sense. It's the largest city. In particular, Burmese refugees. A lot of them are members of the minority Muslim group, the Rohingya, who have been persecuted in Burma. Most of them are going to the Milwaukee metro area. And then most of the Congolese refugees are going to the Fox Cities. So, and primarily Oshkosh, and then this last year, primarily Appleton.
And even though they're taking the most refugees in the state, Milwaukee is actually taking fewer refugees in the last several years?
Yeah, most places, most communities in the state have been taking fewer refugees in the last several years, which mirrors state and national trends. But an interesting thing is the share of refugees going to Milwaukee has been shrinking for the last 5 years. So the overall number of refugees and then the proportion of refugees arriving in the state is also smaller in Milwaukee in 2019 than it was just a few years previously. And a lot of that is because of a growing share of those refugees going to the Fox Cities and to a lesser extent to Madison and Dane County.
And do we know why they're going places other than Milwaukee or why refugees settle where they do?
So refugees, that's a really, really good question. And a lot of it is dictated by just the resettlement agencies that are present in a local community. And World Relief, the resettlement agency in the Fox Cities, has been really, really busy and active in resettling Congolese refugees. And actually, for the last few years, they've mostly just been reuniting families. So with refugees that arrived initially in 2013, 2014, now their immediate family members are joining them. And so that's what the majority of those new arrivals are.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisConText, and we're talking about international refugee communities in Wisconsin. And let's talk a little bit about the state's history with refugee resettlement. What kind of context should we put this year's numbers in?
Yeah, Wisconsin has a long history of refugee resettlement, welcoming refugees. It's one of 3 states that in the 1970s and early 1980s accepted, resettled tens of thousands of Hmong refugees. So these are refugees from the Vietnam War. They were originally living in Laos, escaped to Thailand and lived in refugee camps in Thailand, and then hundreds of thousands overall, but tens of thousands arrived in Wisconsin in the 70s and 80s. Wisconsin has been accepting refugees pretty much every year since then. There is a pretty major spike in the early 2000s as the last refugee camps in Thailand that had Hmong refugees living there closed. And so there was a wave of several thousand new Hmong refugees arriving in the early 2000s. And then since the early 2000s, the mix has really become much more diverse in where refugees are coming from. A lot are still coming from Asia, but then also the Middle East, Sub-Saharan Africa. And that has really it was growing quite a lot, as it was nationally, up until 2016 when things changed.
And you are acknowledging that things have changed. What are you hearing from resettlement agencies when you're talking with people who do this work? How do they see things have changed?
Things have changed quite a bit with the new administration. The Trump administration is generally warier of pretty much all things immigration, and that includes the refugee resettlement program. But the director of World Relief, Fox Valley, who I talked to, said that 2019 was actually surprisingly a pretty good year for them. And by good year, I mean they were able to resettle quite a number of refugees. But again, as I mentioned earlier, most of those are family members who are reuniting with refugees who are already living here. And that's those family reunifications are a priority for both the UN and the U.S. State Department. And so I think that's why most of that is that's what is happening mostly now.
What are we seeing in communities in Wisconsin? There's some support for resettling refugees here in different parts of Wisconsin.
Yes, that's actually a very new change that's happened now, this kind of like explicit support by government officials, because there was an executive order that President Trump signed in September of last year in 2019 requiring states and quote-unquote localities to provide written consent for refugees to be resettled within their borders or jurisdictions. So what that means is that a state's governor or a county board of supervisors or a mayor has to write a letter saying, I support the resettlement of refugees in my community, or we as a board support that. And so what we're finding in Wisconsin, Governor Evers signed such a letter in December. A whole bunch of communities with significant refugee populations have also done so. A bunch of counties, Brown County, Dane County, Eau Claire County, Calumet, Winnebago, Milwaukee, Sheboygan, and then several cities, Madison, Milwaukee, Sheboygan, and Green Bay, and Appleton as well. And then there are other local governments that are expected to write those letters still, including Outagamie County, which is where Appleton is.
And are they on deadline?
They are. They are. Yep. That deadline is January 21st. So it all has to happen pretty quickly.
If they want to declare their support for refugees in their communities.
Exactly. Because and if they don't, that is considered that community is off limits to resettlement. So if a governor were to not write that letter, the whole state would be off limits. But that's not the case in Wisconsin.
All right. Will Cushman, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was WPR host Keely Boltina speaking with Will Cushman of WisContext. If you want to read more about refugee resettlement trends in Wisconsin, you can find Will's story and other items on the topic online at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, we'll discuss the week's top political stories, including President Trump's remarks this morning after an Iranian missile strike on two military bases in Iraq. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin voters will head to the polls in April for the state's partisan presidential primary, and the Republican ballot may end up without a lot of choices. We'll talk about a move yesterday to block some of President Trump's primary challengers from the ballot. First, we're taking a look at the week in national politics. The Senate trial on impeachment is shaping up. The first presidential primary contest is less than a month away. And this morning, President Trump delivered remarks following an Iranian strike on two Iraqi military bases housing U.S. troops. No one was killed in the attacks, which came in retaliation for the killing of a top Iranian commander in a U.S. drone strike. The president did not announce a military response, but did say more economic sanctions on Iran would be put in place.
The fact that we have this great military and equipment, however, does not mean we have to use it. We do not want to use it. American strength, both military and economic, is the best deterrent.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1061.
1234. What do you make of the president's remarks today? Are you relieved, concerned, or somewhere in between? Do you think that last week's escalation with Iran was a needed display of strength or a dangerous mistake? Is something like this a key voting issue for you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
Well, let's start with Iran. President Trump didn't say anything about new military operations, but still had some strong words. What did you make of his tone today?
Well, you know, President Trump has always sent sort of mixed signals and sometimes conflicting signals about use of force, about military action, about international intervention and involvement. And I think this speech sort of fit into that. I mean, it was interesting that the perceptions of the speech ranged from conciliatory in some quarters to sort of defiant and saber-rattling in other quarters. And that I think, you know, I think that's reflective of the fact that he has both been really aggressive in his rhetoric and aggressive in some cases in his actions, as we've just seen. At the same time, there's this constant refrain about not wanting to bog America down in wars in the Middle East. And so there was something, you know, there was something of that in his speech. And if you're if you go into this sort of seeing Trump as a figure of strength, this speech may have kind of and his recent actions are probably reinforcing that. And if you go into this situation perceiving him as reckless, the same thing goes.
Trump, not for the first time, certainly criticized the nuclear deal that President Obama reached with Iran in 2015, and in that address today encouraged other countries in the United Nations to abandon the deal. That deal has been one of the biggest distinctions he's drawn between himself and Obama. How does the actions of the last week fit into that?
Well, it fits in the sense that he's, he's basically tearing up the old status quo. He's been kind of relentlessly critical of that deal, and the question is what replaces it, and whether what replaces it is just an ongoing kind of adversarial dynamic and relationship, or whether it's replaced in the end by kind of a new understanding. And that's something that really remains to be seen.
We're talking with Craig Gilbert of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, starting off our look at the week in Washington news with reactions to President Trump's statements today about Iran. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones now. And Gene in Reedsburg is up. Hi, Gene.
Howdy.
Hi.
I'd have to say I'm in support of what Trump did because there's a lady that's actually from Iran that was talking about the gentleman that we took out, or one of the two, and she was saying that he even led an execution of protesters in Iran that were young kids. So, I mean, a guy that could do that really doesn't have any reason to live.
Well, thanks for that call, Gene. And Craig, is that a fairly common response for people who support the president's actions?
Yeah, I mean, I think, this is somewhat reminiscent of the debate over removing Saddam, in the sense that, the argument on one side of the equation is the world is better off without X, without Saddam, without Soleimani. Then the counter is, okay, but what are the costs? That's the benefit. What are the costs? And how do those two things, net out? So if you're supportive of the action, you're kind of focused on what you see as the virtues of removing this malign actor from the scene. And if you're skeptical, dubious, or opposed to the action, I think you're focused on, well, okay, that's fine, but what are the costs? And are we setting into motion a chain of events that we're going to regret later on? I think those are the two faces of that debate.
Let's go back to the phones, and Tom in Madison is up. Hello, Tom.
Yeah. Hi, thank you. I think ascribing any kind of strategy to Trump's behavior is giving him way more than the benefit of the doubt. I mean, we've had him threaten to destroy cultural sites throughout what we would call Persia in the old days. And then he would basically, Pompeo would come back and say, no, we're not going to do that. And the Pentagon comes back and says a third thing. Basically, we have an angry five-year-old who's tweeting tantrums. And I don't think we have anything more than that.
Thanks for that call, Tom. And Craig, do we have a sense of where the idea for this came from? Was it directly from President Trump or his defense advisors counseling him on this?
Well, I think some of the reports have suggested, and I'm not bringing any firsthand knowledge to this, but some of the reports have suggested this was an option that was presented to him by the military, but not necessarily in the expectation that it would be chosen. And so, you know, we really don't know at this point exactly what the internal dynamic was. I think, you know, one thing about something the caller said, which is also, you know, it's kind of we've seen, I think, time and again in the, you know, kind of when people are, you know, in the reaction and in the perceptions and the interpretations of the president's actions, there's this sort of running debate over how much, you know, method there is to it. And, you know, on the one hand, is he crazy like a fox? And is the bluster, you know, serving a purpose? On the other hand, is there, as the caller suggests, is there just no method to it? Is it just, an expression of his temperament? And that's, I think we've seen that discussion, you know, time and time again, when the president does things that are dramatic or unexpected.
When word of the initial U.S. drone strike happened and was being publicized, there was a lot of outcry from especially Democrats in Congress saying they had not been briefed. Craig, what is the process here? When is the president supposed to brief Congress on actions like this, and is it mandated?
Well, this is a really murky area, and it's been a subject of long-running debate between the two branches, and that is exactly kind of what the obligations are of the executive and also what the role of Congress is. When is the president required to go to Congress for authorization of the use of force, and what kind of force requires, you know, that kind of authorization, or, you know, either before the fact or after the fact. And this is, you know, this is, it's a shifting question, and it's a question that obviously has been debated between lawmakers and the White House for a long time. I mean, presidents have made, you know, a variety of decisions about when they wanted to go to Congress for authorization, even for, you know, much more sustained use of force than we just saw recently. So it's not entirely a settled question, and we're already seeing in response to this a potential move on the part of House Democrats to try to do things to curb the president's, you know, freedom of maneuver with respect to this.
Well, I understand, Craig, that there was actually a briefing this afternoon, and there were some comments being made as representatives, senators were on their way out. Who was being briefed this afternoon?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I'm not in Washington. I'm actually in Wisconsin at the moment, but I do know that. That, you know, for Democrats, there's, I think, a mixture of relief so far, at least, that this isn't escalating. At the same time, kind of, you know, again, for Democrats and for critics of President Trump, they see this as a danger sign in terms of his conduct. And they also see it as overreach in terms of his powers. Obviously, on the Republican side, there's pretty strong, I would say, support among Republican lawmakers for what the president did, although there is some debate, I think, on the right, as we've seen in the past with the use of force, over whether this was the right thing to do. I mean, there's a strain of thinking on the right that President Trump has tapped into at times, which is to kind of keep the U.S. out of these entanglements. And there's also kind of a tradition of a more hawkish and interventionist tradition on the right. And what we're seeing is President Trump kind of, I think, you know, shifting between those two. And then you get, again, some debate among conservatives over whether this is the way to go, both for reasons of, you know, both with respect to the debate we were talking about executive power, but also just about foreign policy.
And interestingly, what you just said there, Craig, Mike Lee, who is a Republican senator from Utah, came out of that briefing not happy at all. Here are a couple quotes from him. He said, "One of the messages that we received from the briefers was, do not debate, do not discuss the issue of inappropriateness of further military intervention against Iran, and that if you do, you'll be emboldening Iran." He also said, "I find this insulting and demeaning, not personally, but to the office that each of the 100 senators in this building have happens to hold. I find it insulting and demeaning to the Constitution of the United States." That's a pretty interesting response to the briefing.
Yeah. And again, whether or not you if you're a Republican lawmaker, whether or not you approve of the policy or not, there's this sort of separate question of what are the prerogatives of the executive and what are the prerogatives of the legislature. And, you know, for some conservatives and for many liberals, too, that's a burning question. And so I think we're going to see these kinds of tensions, going forward as well.
We're talking with Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about the week in national politics. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation with Craig, and we'll be looking at the state of the presidential race and what it's going to take for any candidate to win in Wisconsin. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our talk now with Craig Gilbert of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the week in national politics. And Craig, let's move on to how the Senate trial on impeachment is shaping up. One of the big questions is whether or not the trial will include witnesses that can testify to President Trump's dealings with Ukraine. What's the latest on the witness issue?
Well, the position that the Majority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell has taken is that he's going to take the approach that the Senate took in the case of the Clinton impeachment. I covered the Clinton impeachment and back in 1998 on the House side and 1999 on the Senate side. And what the Senate did then was they agreed not to decide that question up front. The difference was they actually came to kind of a unanimous agreement for launching the process. And part of that, one feature of that agreement is that after the House managers, impeachment managers, one of whom was from Wisconsin, Jim Sensenbrenner, presented their case, then the Senate would vote on things like whether to dismiss the charges, whether to have witnesses. And that's what happened. I mean, it was several weeks into the process when the Senate took a vote on witnesses. They rejected the idea of live in-person testimony, but they voted to depose by videotape three witnesses, including Monica Lewinsky, and then portions of that testimony were played back during the trial. So that was how the Senate did it during the Clinton impeachment trial. Democrats argue that this is not an analogous situation, so it should be handled differently. But basically, the Republicans hold the cards here, and so Mitch McConnell has not flatly ruled out in the end witnesses. The question is going to be, if they start without an agreement for witnesses, will there be an opportunity for the Senate to take a vote as the process unfolds on whether to have witnesses or not? But he's not offering any of those assurances up front.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has not yet released the articles to the Senate yet, and she says that the trial won't start until she does. It sounds like Senate leaders think that they can start at least part of that process you talked about before they get the articles. What would that look like?
Well, I mean, there's some expectation now that she may release those articles, in the near future. There's been a little bit of jockeying going on, and some Senate Democrats are now starting to say, let's get on with it. You may find it may not come to a situation where they start the trial without actually receiving the articles. I think we're looking at a trial that begins without resolving up front the question of witnesses.
And of course, all of this impeachment talk and action is happening with the 2020 election looming. And the Iowa caucus is less than a month away. Milwaukee is gearing up to host the Democratic National Convention in July. Which candidates do you see having some momentum right now?
Well, I think what's, you know, the short story of what's happened in recent months is that, you know, some people have dropped out, including some notable Democrats like Senator Kamala Harris of California. And we've seen, you know, kind of a big four emerge of Biden, Warren, Sanders and Buttigieg, but also maybe room for Amy Klobuchar. And then the Bloomberg, Mike Bloomberg factor, where he's spending a lot of money, and that's kind of an X factor. And then, you know, everything that goes on in the so-called invisible primary is very quickly superseded when states start voting, which is obviously going to happen soon in the case of Iowa. And so every time another state votes, it introduces it, it changes the dynamic, and it kind of erases a lot of things, a lot of assumptions about past assumptions about how this was going to play out. So it becomes a lot more unpredictable, and especially when you have, you know, the field is going to change, the size of the field and the members of the field are going to change, and the playing field itself is going to change as we move from state to state, and the rules are going to change as we move from state to state in terms of who, you know, whether it's a primary or caucus and whether it's an open primary or not. So all those things just present like a dizzying set of variables that, that makes it impossible to really, I think, know what it's going to look like by the time we get to Wisconsin on April 7th. Wisconsin, you know, by the time Wisconsin votes, I think 70% of the pledged delegates will have been chosen essentially or allocated to the candidates. And so, you know, that will put us in a position where somebody may not have a majority. It's very hard under the Democratic rules to carve out a majority or even carve out much of a delegate lead because everything is allocated proportionally, not just on the basis of statewide results, but on the basis of congressional district level results in the presidential primary. And so basically it ensures that the delegate count remains pretty close and pretty competitive in a fractured field. So I think I have every expectation that, that we will not have a majority nominee by the time Wisconsin rolls around, but we may have a de facto nominee or a de facto leader, and Wisconsin could be, as a standalone state, a very dramatic late-stage contest between, you know, between two or three remaining viable contenders.
Well, and certainly Wisconsin was very key in the election of President Trump in 2016. I know that there was a media walkthrough of the Fiserv Forum for the DNC in Milwaukee yesterday. I think that's where you're joining us from today, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I was at that walkthrough. I'm in Milwaukee now, partly because of that and, you know, it was interesting. I mean, a lot of it was sort of logistics and planning and workspace issues, but there was a fair amount of discussion about Wisconsin as a battleground, and there were briefings on the record by Democrats about their view of Wisconsin and the competitiveness of Wisconsin. And, you know, I would say it's kind of like there's sort of two messages that Democrats are trying to communicate about Wisconsin, which are somewhat at odds with each other. And one is that, you know, we're in really good shape and President Trump is in really bad shape in Wisconsin. And the second message is we know it's going to be really close and competitive and we're prepared to fight for every vote and we can't take anything for granted. And so I think, you know, I think we all understand that this is a hugely competitive state that could easily be decided by a very small margin, as it was in 2016, as it was in 2004, as it was in 2000.
And President Trump is actually coming to Wisconsin next Tuesday, speaking in Milwaukee. What are you going to be watching for in his remarks at that rally?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of his rallies have been in Republican territory or red states or even less Democratic cities than Milwaukee. So the setting is interesting because he's coming into a very blue city. Although, you know, a lot of the people who attend the rally are going to be from, you know, outside the city of Milwaukee. So it's also, you know, you always keep in mind the moment in time at which he's speaking, and we're coming off, you know, again, this, you know, these series chain of events related to Iran, and we're, as we've talked about, in the midst of this sort of impeachment process. Those are two pretty dramatic kind of backdrops politically for this speech, as well as, you know, the coming election and the fact that, you know, again, as we discussed, he's speaking from a state that he narrowly won, the Democrats absolutely need to win back, and that both sides are going to, you know, kind of leave no stone unturned.
Craig, thanks so much for joining us. Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was with us for a look at the week in Washington. And tomorrow after 4, we're going to be talking more about Iran. We'll be joined by an advisor to the Defense Department. Do you remember what you were doing in 1977, if you were even born? Wisconsinite Kevin Kinney knows where he was. He was studying abroad in Europe and traveling around. He left his Hayward High School class ring on a train. Kinney said that he would think about the ring about once a year or so and would wonder what had happened to it. Well, believe it or not, now he knows. In November, he got an email from a woman in Australia. Here's Kenny talking about getting that message.
I think I have your high school class ring, and there was a picture of it attached to the email, and I just started laughing.
It turns out that the woman's grandfather bought a pair of gloves in a flea market in Athens, Greece in the 1980s, and strangely enough, the ring was inside one of them. She wanted to find the owner, so posted it on Facebook, and the post eventually made its way to someone who recognized what school it was from. Kinney got the ring back recently thanks to the kindness and tenacity of that woman on the other side of the world, and he's now given it to his daughter to have. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk about a move yesterday to block President Trump's Republican challengers from the primary ballot in Wisconsin ahead of the state's April presidential primary. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.